Hello, listeners. This is David Blakesley welcoming you to episode 144 of the Criterion Reflections podcast. This is a podcast in which I and my guests are talking about all the films affiliated with the Criterion Collection in the chronological order of its original theatrical release. And here we are in February of 1973 talking about Wattstacks, a film directed by Mel Stewart, largely African-American performers at the famous Wattstacks concert in Los Angeles, California, in August of 1972, an event that celebrated the 7th anniversary of the infamous Watts riots that took place in 1965. Wattstacks is a pretty legendary concert of its era from the early 70s, headlined by Isaac Hayes, with very significant contributions from the Staple Singers and the Bar Kays and Rufus Thomas and Carla Thomas. And there's also appearances by Little Milton and Albert King and the Emotions and a bunch of other performers, as well as narration by Richard Pryor, who's very funny but also very on point with his observations. So me and my guests are going to have a lot to say about the film. I'm just here to kind of welcome you to the episode. We're going to have it in two separate segments. I'm going to be talking with Richard first, and then James will make his debut after Richard and I have had our piece. James and I will have a conversation to get his impressions of Wattstacks. You'll hear that all three of us had very pleasantly and positive feelings for this film. We all enjoyed it quite a bit, and I'd say we all probably enjoyed it maybe even a little bit more than we expected. I'll say this, I was not expecting I would be doing a podcast episode about the movie. I thought maybe I'd just do a little short YouTube clip, and that is still the scheme that I have in mind to try to keep things moving, but because I'm a busy guy and I do other things besides these podcasts, I've been averaging about one a month so far this year. We'll see if I can pick up the pace, but I did have to slow things down a little bit so that I could talk about Wattstacks, because I think it's an important film, of course, very entertaining, but it's a lot more than just a musical event captured on film. This is also kind of kicking off a bit of a trilogy of black-centered cinema. I'm going to be talking about Black Caesar, a blaxploitation film starring Fred Williamson, directed by Larry Cohen, also written by Larry Cohen. And then the third in this little trilogy is going to be The Harder They Come, a legendary kind of breakthrough of reggae into popular culture at the time. Great soundtrack by Jimmy Cliff and others from the nation of Jamaica. So a pretty impressive run of films coming up very soon on Criterion Reflections. But that's enough of my intro. I just wanted to kind of kick things off with a little bit of a welcome, a little explanation of what we got going for you. And now let's get to the conversation with our guests, Richard and James, and me. Enjoy the episode. Thanks for listening in. All right, I am here with Richard Doyle, my first guest, as we talk about Wattstacks, Mel Stewart, 1973, from a concert from 1972. Richard, always great to have you on. Welcome back.
Thanks, good to be here.
Yeah, so I've already had a few things to say in the intro and also in my YouTube clip there about Wattstacks. So I'm going to just kind of throw it right over your way. Tell me how much of experience you've had with this film. Is this a first-time watch for you, or have you known of it for a while?
I've known of it for quite a while, but I've never seen it before now. It was not all that easy to find for many years. So I think I had missed the fact that it was now as it seems to have been on DVD for many years. I actually bought it on DVD.
Okay. I think there's two editions out there. One is like the 30th anniversary edition that was like in the early 2000s. And then the one that's currently available just called Special Edition. They're probably the exact same disc, but I just wondered which one that you got.
I believe I got the 30th anniversary one.
Okay, so that's an older one, but I don't think the transfer or anything has changed. But obviously we're well past the 30th anniversary of Wattstack.
No, it was a very nice copy of it. So
yeah.
It seems good.
Well, so tell me just about your impressions of the film. I may want to go back to the disc and what other special features are on it, if there are any. But just let's talk about the film first. Wattstax, the event, the soundtrack, the visuals. Now, what was your impression?
I was surprised at how much of the film doesn't really directly relate to the concert.
Yeah.
Which I think is both a strength and a weakness of it in a way. I think maybe the balance is a little bit too far away from the concert at times. I think some of the performers got a little bit of a short shrift.
Yeah.
Here's Albert King and here's half a song by him.
Yeah. 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 And then that scene where the barques, like, you know, they do their piece and then it's like, we want to give you the opportunity to get down. And it's like, okay, let's go into an extended jam. It's like immediate cutaway. It's like, I wanted to get down. Yeah. Yeah.
I got the feeling that Woodstock documentary was a big influence here, right? Where they were, which is similarly as much about the, you know, the context as the music. So
yeah, the event, the people, the crowd, the scene in the stands, all that, right?
Yeah. That said, I thought, you know, Woodstock was such a big and colorful event that, you know, the people there were basically covering the concert too. But here I was intrigued by the idea of like turning this into, you know, a documentary as much about Watts as about the concert. Mm-hmm. I thought at times it was a little repetitive, but not annoyingly so. Like I enjoyed it quite a bit. That said, would have liked to see a little bit more of the concert. But
yeah, well, and that does kind of get me to that point about special features. Well, is there anything on the disc of like outtakes or extended musical sequences? I think of like the Criterion edition of Monterey Pop, where you've got, you know, you've got the classic film, the A. Pennebaker and his crew, and then they have split it out into, you know, Jimi Hendrix and Otis Redding sets each kind of have their own dedicated short film. And then on the Criterion edition, you also get this bonus disc, which is basically all the other salvageable footage, including like the Grateful Dead and a lot of bands that, or even some of the headliners that made it into the main feature. Other songs, you know, so it's a really beautiful document that has pretty much everything, you know, that was captured on video. And I would love to see a Wattstax edition that has all that cool stuff, if it's out there anywhere, but I don't know that it is. Yeah.
There's not that much on it because it's a mm-hmm. Warner Archive release.
Okay.
Right? So it's pretty much a, here's the film. I didn't dig too deeply into what else might be on there, but it didn't look like there was a ton of stuff on there. I don't think there's any great lost footage from this.
Right.
Film.
There's a great soundtrack. In fact, there's a lot of audio out there. I found I use YouTube Music for streaming, and there's like, you know, sold out, the complete Wattstax, which is like basically the entire concert, or at least maybe there's a few things that they had to leave out. But there's also a lot of extra material, kind of like the film, where they kind of go into some of the kind of surrounding scenes, you know, like Johnny Taylor at the nightclub and some of these other performances that took place outside the festival itself, but definitely capture the spirit of the times and some of the acts that maybe didn't get their screen time in the feature film.
Yeah, my understanding is most of those are people who couldn't make the concert itself, but they wanted to include it. And I think some of those are wonderful. You get sort of the whole performance there. It's the Emotions, I think, doing the gospel number and Johnny Taylor and club. I thought that stuff was really great. It's interesting that they try to, as much as possible, tie the what they're talking to the people about to the song that you've just heard.
Yeah. There's some very cool editing stuff going on as far as, you know, the director, Mel Stewart's decisions. And in the show notes, there's actually a little, I didn't send you the clips ahead of time, Richard. Sorry about that. But there's a page of Mel Stewart from the Directors Guild of America, DGA. And there's actually a clip, about 2 or 3 minute clip of him talking about his experience of making Watt Stacks the film. Basically he says, you know, it was a newsreel of a concert when you just took all the footage from the LA Coliseum gig and put it in there in sequence. It was a pretty unremarkable film that was, you know, it was great performances, but he didn't feel like that was what he does. He says, I'm a documentarian, even though he's done a lot of other stuff, and we'll get into some of his other career achievements, but he wanted to make a film that had more kind of substance to it, and so they basically did. They just, you know, toured around the neighborhood of Watts, and they got, you know, people, just street folks, just regular folks from different walks of life in the local community, to talk about their experiences, their views on politics and religion and male female relationships and, you know, gambling or whatever, you know, just the issues of life that were on their minds. And he wanted just to kind of get them loosened up, talking and sharing their perspective on the Black experience at that time. And I think it did, like you said, it made it a much more interesting film, although I had that same reaction. It's like, well, you know, where's more of the concert footage? I mean, some of these dialogues go on for like several minutes, you know? It's not just little interludes. This is like a whole sequence right here, yeah.
Yeah, I also would have got the feeling that given who Mel Stewart was at the time, he wasn't very tapped into the music. So,
right. He was brought in as a documentary filmmaker because he had done, I think there was what was another feature? He did another film before this that sort of made him a candidate to do this.
I know he did some famous films about the Kennedys.
Maybe it was. It was the 4 days in November about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Everything before that were all, you know, kind of, you know, mainstream Hollywood feature. So he must have had some other, you know, experience doing documentary film. And I think he worked with the David Wolper Group, which is the kind of the production company that sort of put this on. So, yeah, there's some interesting backstory of how this event came together. And again, that would make another interesting sort of supplemental feature because it is kind of a unique little, you know, chain of events that resulted in this pretty impressive concert at the Los Angeles Coliseum. So, yeah, how much did you get into sort of the making of or the backstory of how the film came together or any of that?
I read some stuff online about the making of the film and the mm-hmm. staging of the concert.
The
way it came together, because I was curious how the idea came to mark 7 years of the...
yeah, there's some kind of numerological thing. And I don't know, that could have been a little after the fact, like 7 is like our number, man, you know, so whatever. Yeah. But you know, the Watts riots, obviously 1965 really was a turning point in the American Civil Rights Movement when it went from just, you know, I mean, well, there had been violence all along, let's not kid ourselves, but, you know, when it became large-scale urban riots, you know, burning, looting, you know, killing, I mean, just really out of control, that was quite a shockwave. I mean, and really kind of ushered in sort of the second half of the 60s, you could say, as pretty intense violence of all different sorts kind of gripped the culture, whether that's what's happening over in Vietnam, you know, riots in the cities, you had assassinations, you know, a few years later, you had large-scale organized protests of different sorts, free speech movements, various liberation movements and fronts and all of that. And, you know, other urban riots in primarily African-American or Black, you know, neighborhoods, ghettos, if you want to call them that. That was a pretty prominent thing, and the Watts riots were the ones that kind of initiated that string of events. But I also thought this film was kind of captured a pretty remarkable moment because it really was a time where, you know, popular black consciousness seemed to be going through a bit of a transitional phase. You know, I mean, there had been the militancy of the Black Panthers and all of that, but let me ask you, what did you think of like the early portions of the film, like, you know, featuring Jesse Jackson and some of the, what you might call consciousness raising or black pride, you know, really trying to bring a message of uplift and self-respect and empowerment to the people in the crowd that day.
Yeah, actually, I like that stuff a lot. That's one of the other things I thought I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of in the film, like a little bit more about, I gather there were speeches as well as songs, and you, other than the incredibly young Jesse Jackson there.
Yeah, isn't that something to see him in his full power there, yeah.
Yeah, this is really like a time period where the consciousness of black power in popular entertainment is really rising, and the music is starting to transform too. It's a pretty interesting transitional period in this kind of music, you know, with people like Isaac Hayes like becoming really big and sort of changing the face of soul music.
It wasn't like, you know, good-looking guys in dapper suits, you know, and smooth moves, you know, your Wilson Pickett's, your Otis Reddings. I mean, they were great performers, but Isaac Hayes, you know, the Black Moses thing, and obviously his entrance, which is kind of really a kind of the culmination of the finale of the film, is, you know, pretty key moment where he's coming out, and he was at this point kind of the biggest star in black music, or at least one of them, I would say. You know, you and I talked about Shaft a few years ago, and we talked about the music and that soundtrack, and it really was. It was like the sound of the times. It wasn't just a catchy tune. There was just something about the vibe that song put out, and his presence, not just as a handsome guy, but he's a stud. I mean, he's a muscular, you know, fully developed man with deep voice. There's kind of that sexual element, but he's a man who's in charge. He's powerful. He's not, you know, shuffling and tap dancing and smiling for the crowds. He's a black man in his fullness that you got to deal with on his own terms. And I thought, you know, that's quite a presence that he has there. And even the build up before he came on stage. Now, everybody, if you go past the barrier, he's going to have to leave. You don't want to lose that, you know. So all of the crowd management, that's a whole other little sub theme throughout the film in different sequences there.
Did you read that in the theatrical release? That wasn't the same. It's not the same concert footage of him.
Yeah. What was the story there? They didn't have certain rights. Yeah.
Yeah, MGM threatened to sue them if they had used the theme from Shaft in the concert, so they had to splice in some other footage of Isaac Hayes at the time for the theatrical release.
Yeah, which is really quite a shame, because that's his entrance. I mean, that was the moment. That was kind of like the peak there. I mean, they did the song Soulsville afterwards, which I actually thought was a very nice kind of come down, if you will, after, you know, after the kind of the climax, the epitome of Shaft, and you know we pulls his cape off and he's got the gold chain, you know, vest on, and you know it was like, you know, a kind of a powerful display, if you will, when he's making that grand entrance. But then Soulsville, definitely a very, very sweet and kind of slightly mournful song about just the realities of life in these impoverished communities, and yet the people who are, you know, hanging in there and keeping their chin up and persevering through all the adversity that they got to deal with.
Black man, born free, at least that's the way it's supposed to be. Chains that bind him are hard to see, unless you take this walk with me. The place where he lives, he's got plenty of names. Slums, ghetto and black belt, they are one and the same. And I call it
Soulsville.
Any kind of job is hard to
the person I think gets the most screen time and whose performance, whose set I thought was wonderful, was Rufus Thomas.
Oh, absolutely. I have been listening to so much Rufus Thomas over the past several days or week. He is quite a character, and I had sort of been vaguely aware of him. I knew he was the father of Carla Thomas, who was kind of, she was a, you know, a lovely young black singer. She had a few hits in the early years of Stax, or the mid-60s, I guess. And we'll talk about Stax records in a second. But yeah, tell us about Rufus, because I loved his bits as well.
Yeah, I've never seen that much of him in anything, because he's sort of, well, best known for his, like, other than being Carla Thomas's dad for a series of sort of novelty hits, one of which you hear there, the Funky Chicken, right?
Yeah, but works the crowd. Exactly. Yeah. And he, you know, I had to think about, like, how many the juke joints and down and dirty backwoods clubs and you know, urban environments. I mean, all the places this guy had to have been doing his shtick, you know? I mean, I've seen people call it the Chitlin' Circuit or whatever. So he's probably played in the funkiest of places, and he even billed himself as the funkiest man alive. And you know what? I believe it. Really seemed to have a knack. But he was not only, you know, working the crowd, but he's playing this 100,000-seat stadium, you know, which is a landmark in its own right, the L.A. Coliseum, built for the 1932 Olympics, I believe. And, you know, it's just like this iconic presence. I've been there a few times in my life for, you know, big rock concerts back in the 70s and stuff like that. But this is a really unique event. He comes out there in his fuchsia pink, you know, suit, his white go-go boots, and he is just rocking it. the breakdown and do the Funky Chicken and even do the Funky Penguin came after that. And that may be the soundtrack. Go ahead. Yeah.
I was really impressed that apparently he was told, you can kind of see it in the footage, that he was told that they had a deal that they would stay off the field.
Yeah.
So, but I was impressed that when he tells the crowd to get off the field, almost every single one of them just listened to him.
Yeah, he definitely.
I was thinking, good luck with that, man. And then, they just all left.
Well, he called him out. He called him out to do the Funky Chicken. And of course, you know, I think, you know, and that's the thing. This music is just so driving. It just kind of gets into you, you know? And that's asking a lot for all these folks, especially the young folks, to just sit in your seats. You know, I mean, there are a lot of people that are kind of dancing in the aisle there, or maybe in front of their seat. There's that one kind of iconic image of that young black woman, real dark skin, beautiful, you know, white polka dots on a bright red dress, and she's getting down, and it's pretty awesome. But, you know, you can only contain that energy so long before it spills over. And I think, you know, so he says, yeah, come on out and do the Funky Chicken, and it's quite a moment there. But then it's like, uh-oh, I got orders. I got to clear you all out. And you're right. He gives the commands, except for a few stragglers. And then even then, spur of the moment, he's just, like, totally right on it, you know, kind of call him out, you know, riffing on it, and just so much fun.
Yeah, you get the feeling he's very used to dealing with unruly crowds.
Yeah, well, he gets them worked up, and then he's got to cool them down. You know, it's what he does. So really, really fantastic moments, because I think that's another part of the film I really enjoyed quite a bit, is that joyfulness, that kind of that celebration, even though, you know, there, you know, going back to Jesse Jackson's kind of litany that he calls it at the beginning, I may live in the slums, I may be on welfare, I may be in prison, but the prison's not in me, and you know, I am somebody. And I, you know, that I am somebody is almost at this point kind of a stale old cliche. But if you really think about it, if you think about the people he's talking to, that's a pretty uplifting message. And there are a lot of folks who were really down in the dumps and who had just not been treated with respect, not taken seriously, simply because of the label that their dark skin placed on them in that society. And I really appreciated the fact that this wasn't just, you know, a pop concert. This wasn't just a kind of a you know, a big show business spectacle. There was something else going on there.
Some at the time known and unknown celebrities in the crowd too. Like I note that you can see Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee in the crowd.
Yeah.
But one of the dancers is Fred Berry, who ends up on What's Happening.
Yeah, right.
End of the decade.
Yeah.
You can see him for a second. And I kept wondering when we're watching the interviews, I'm like, wait, I know this guy. Who is this guy? It's like Ted Lang from the Love Boat.
Yeah, right.
Interviewing.
And he was just a dude off the street, I think. I don't think he was any special, you know, profiled guest. He just a guy. And I don't know if this was a spur for him to kind of get into show business or if he maybe had some connections or was already in the trade already. But, you know, he had some pretty interesting things to say. I mean, one of the pieces that really stuck to me was, you know, these young men learning when they were the N-word, you know, and I will say, you know, fair warning that there's very liberal use of, you know, derogatory slang that, you know, wouldn't really fly the same today if it came out. But when they realize I'm black and I am kind of second class or worse in the eyes of my white friends or white people in general, I mean, I've been through, you know, racism, healing racism courses. I've read, I've studied, I've considered quite a bit. And I've been taught, as a child, I was taught a lot of that stuff, racist ideology, as just common sense from my older relatives. So I've focused on this topic from time to time over the years and sometimes at great length. But it's always moving when you sort of recognize these guys are kind of telling their story where it's like, oh, wow. This is this kind of condition I got to spend the rest of my life in now. It's kind of like, I don't know, there's kind of a stunning aspect to that the film just kind of hit me that way as they were kind of sharing some of their experiences.
Yeah. I think it's one of the stronger parts of the, it's stronger than the, I think, a little bit overdone bits of, have you ever cheated on your wife? That seems to go on for like 10 minutes.
Well, you know, and I, that was part of that was probably the one aspect of the film where I wish maybe they could gone a little different direction. Although I don't know. I mean, it is what the people were saying. I don't think they were given scripted lines, but you know, there was a lot of time spent on infidelity and cheating and running around and slipping out the back door. And, you know, the one piece that is in the trailer, you know, how'd you get that scar? You know, that's pretty funny actually. But it's like, they really do kind of hammer that point home. You know, black men are kind of shiftless and undependable and, you know, all the issues. And then when you throw a white woman in the mix, oh boy, now here we go. And so in a way it sort of fed into some stereotypes, you could say, but it was perhaps what was on their mind, you know.
I also think a lot of what they were, the topic seemed time to be guided towards whatever was the last or the next song you were going to hear. Yeah. So I think there's a whole section on, you know, people having the blues because you're about to hear a blues singer, right?
Yeah, right.
And I think there was a song about infidelity, so they were asking about that. But I felt like it did get a little bit.
Jody's got your girl and gone. Yeah, you know, that's all about, you know, those fly guys who kind of come in sweet talking, and of course the women who go for the Jody's, you know, and the guys. I mean, because there were a couple of those guys that they were interviewing who had been kind of heartbroken, and you know, she called the moving van and left me, you know, and broke my heart. I'll never be the same. So those are the kind of sincere down on their luck guys. But you know, you got your players and you got your, you know, flashy, you know, whatever types, you know, the guys who are just kind of on the move and on the make and, you know, love them and leave them and all of that. So just a fascinating variety of styles and attitudes coming through there.
Yeah, and I guess it's worth reflecting that, you know, none of this material would really be seen on film outside of the context of, like, blaxploitation films and things like that. So it is fascinating that they get, you know, real people talking about their real lives and things, mm-hmm. which is not mm-hmm. a common thing in 1973.
Right. And I think this is a movie that was made primarily for the black community. I mean, that's another piece. Let's talk about that. Yeah. How kind of segregated the audience was. I mean, it was almost entirely black. And, you know, you could not put out a concert, even with all those, you know, black performers, you would not get as, you know, homogenous a crowd, if you will, you know, of all one race, anybody these days. But that was very much, I think, you know, not that they wouldn't have sold tickets to a white guy or white family or whatever, but this was seen as a black event. And if you weren't black, you might not be comfortable there, or you might not feel like you were welcome. But it was just a really interesting, I guess they kept the ticket prices down to $1 a seat. It was a fundraiser. The performers, I think, donated their time and labor, maybe had their costs covered or whatever. So, you know, there was kind of a social component. You know, they're raising money for the Watts Neighborhood Association or some group of that sort, which is probably, you know, providing some fairly important essential services for people in that community, or at least some resources that the community would benefit from. This wasn't just a cash grab to, you know, capitalize on the fame of these great performers.
Yeah, I'm like by no means could swear by this, but I would also think in 1973, out of the people I saw in the bill, only Isaac Hayes and the Staple Singers would have played widely to white audiences.
Right. They had radio hits, you know, that were on the mainstream, like top 40 type of stations, not just the rhythm and blues or the soul stations in the cities and all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. How any other performers that stood out? I mean, I mentioned the Barcades once already. They were pretty cool, pretty flashy. I mean, they were kind of out on the edge of the sax player with his big kind of white silver afro going on.
Apparently they had been told they had wanted to come on the stage in horse-driven chariots, and were told that they were not allowed to upstage Isaac Hayes.
Well, plus they'd probably torn up the field as well, which was a working football field. Now, it's weird because I read sort of the account of why they were so concerned about crowd control and keeping people off the field, because apparently a game had been played the night before. So they had to, you know, build the stadium in the middle of the night, you know, wooden planks and, you know, an overnight crew puts it up, and then they have to take it down because there was going to be a game played like the next day or 2 days later. And it's like, when do they ever play football games 2 or 3 days apart? Like, what's, I mean, I've never heard about that. So I don't know if these were, and it was in August, so maybe they were.
In the same stadium, too.
Yeah, in the same stadium, right. It's like, did a different team play in there? I mean, because football players need to recover after a game. They don't just turn around and do double headers or anything like that. So it was kind of odd that was a dynamic, and why would they have scheduled it that close to such a major event either?
That's what I was wondering about too. When I did read about the game being the day before, and I was thinking, well, that wasn't well planned, was it?
Yeah, you could have maybe stretched this out a little bit more.
Yeah.
Now, we haven't talked about Richard Pryor, so we got to give some time for Richard Pryor before we wrap up this segment. But what'd you think? I don't think he was a known guy at this time, right? This might have even been his first major film performance.
He's in, I think he's in The Mac like a year before this, but that's not exactly, it's not a huge part and it's not major, right? This is like almost exactly the time period where he was nixed as the star of Blazing Saddles. So,
was he originally cast for that or going for it?
Yeah, he co-wrote the movie.
Oh,
he's one of the co-writers of Blazing Saddles.
I didn't know that. Okay, interesting.
Yeah, it's apparently four people wrote that movie, and he's one of the ones.
Okay,
and they wanted him in the Cleavon Little part, and the studio totally nixed it because he'd had drug arrests, and they didn't think he was the right person.
I think Cleavon Little did fine in that role, but and then Richard Pryor, he's in on it. And he I'm sure gave him a lot of the best lines, right?
Yeah, yeah. But no, I think his, like, as a real mainstream, like, presence in the media, it's mid to late 70s.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
He may have had albums by now that sold pretty well, but that's...
Yeah, well, in that little short clip I mentioned from Mel Stewart, he talked about kind of, you know, he kind of just fell into Richard Pryor's orbit. They had done the primary filming of the concert. They'd done a lot of the street and the just kind of roundtable conversations, if you will, with different members of the community. They'd done a lot of the location shots and, you know, kind of the B-roll of the different, you know, neighborhood scenes. And I think there were even scenes from outside of Watts, and there was newsreel footage of the Watts riots and all kinds of stuff like that. But they wanted one more ingredient, which is all sort of like almost like a narrator or somebody to kind of get the laughs going. You know, there's some funny bits in the interviews there, but somebody who could really nail it. And he was told by some of the Black folks that he was, you know, working on the movie with, said, "Oh, go check out this Richard Pryor guy. He's playing at this nightclub in Watts." And Mel Stewart's like, "I'm not going to be going down to Watts on a Saturday night by myself, you know?" And so he, you know, he had some accompaniment there, and he tells a little anecdote about how he was first kind of rebuffed and kind of questioned, "Why are you here?" And then, you know, his Black friend kind of stood up for him and got him in. But that's basically how he, you know, connected with Richard Pryor. And he was right off camera just saying, "Tell me about religion. Tell me about gambling. Tell me about women."
Yeah.
And that was Richard Pryor, just spur of the moment, just riffing off of whatever prompt Mel Stewart sent his way. And again, just, you know, some of it's gut-splittingly funny, some of it's kind of a preview of, you know, characterizations and, you know, the way he does his voice tone, that kind of whiny stuff. It's just really something else.
I liked it a lot.
And really, it was quite a fortuitous, because I think it does elevate Wattstacks into what I feel is a pretty important film, you know, for its time and what it's capturing. And it does seem to me like it's being a bit neglected, that you've got two kind of obscuro DVD-only releases that really have to go out of your way to look for. I ended up buying a $10 Prime Video file just so I could have it and not do a rental and watch it a few times. And I'm really glad I own it, because, like I say, I just put it on as musical background, or just capturing this moment, this slice of life.
Yeah, it's really not that well known. And I can't think of anything comparable for the period. Like, there's not that kind of event that gets the film coverage. I've only ever really read about it in the context of, you know, movies about music in the 70s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But even then, it feels like it must be underwatched, because it's not talked about in any great detail. For instance, I had no expectation that there was this much, like, talking heads interviews.
Yeah, no, that was very much a surprise to me as well, and that they really went out of their way to let the people speak. I mean, there are several characters who got, you know, quite a few minutes if you put it all together. They're strung throughout the film, and you kind of get to know what's on their mind, and it's kind of endearing in some ways, just to let them speak their piece. And these are just, you know, straight up off the street, never going to be famous. The Ted Langs and Richard Pryors aside, a lot of these folks are as anonymous as it gets. But they got their moment. They got their chance to say what they had to say, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's actually, it might be the case. And normally I wouldn't think this was a good thing, but, like, Mel Stewart, as someone who works for, like, David L. Wolper, is a much more traditional documentary filmmaker than the kinds of guys who were doing music documentaries in this period, like mm-hmm. the Baselys and stuff.
Right.
So you figure if they had done it, it would have been, you know, fly on the wall stuff behind the staging of the of this concert itself, and you never would have had these kind of interviews in it. So it's almost fortuitous that somebody much more conventional made this film.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about Mel Stewart, and we can kind of wrap up this piece here. So, yeah, what's Mel Stewart most famous for, Richard?
Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Willy Wonka, which is just about the whitest movie I could ever think of. You know,
and he made it right before this.
It's pretty amazing. And again, a director for hire. But, you know, he's a Jewish guy as well. And we're going to talk a little bit about Jewish directors telling Black stories when we get to our next conversation about Black Caesar. That one being directed by Larry Cohen and starring Fred Williamson, but we'll save that for the other time. But it's very interesting how that fell together, and I think Mel Stewart did kind of that of Hollywood liberal perspective and wanting to probably do some social good in putting this film together as well. He seems like a decent guy, a real career industry guy. You know, he's won Emmy Awards, Academy Awards. You know, he's Directors Guild of America has a page dedicated to him. So, you know, he's a real industry insider guy. But I think he was, you know, kind of trying to, you know, do a little public service in the process of pursuing his filmmaking career as well.
Yeah. I would imagine this feels like a film by a very progressive fella.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, any final words or observations you want to share with us, Richard, before we wrap it up?
Only another callback. You get to see a brief shot of Melvin Van Peebles. I think he introduces the Staples.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point, and maybe one I'll follow up on with our next guest. But yeah, Melvin Van Peebles. He's there in his shades. He is also at the kind of peak of his power. You know, we did what's that one?
Don't Play Us Cheap.
Don't Play Us Cheap, right. We did that with my friend Aaron Strand, and we talked about Sweet Sweet back a while back there. So Melvin Van Peebles was very much quite the behind-the-scenes figure in all of this. And that was cool to see him kind of, you know, not in character, out of character, just being himself, but as an organizer and as kind of a cultural rallying point, which this event kind of turned on. So, yeah, great observation. Thanks for pointing that out. All right, Richard, it's been nice talking to you. Thanks for your contributions and chat tonight. Always good.
All right.
I am here with James Merritt, and I personally am just really excited and happy to be finally making the direct connection with you, James. So welcome to Criterion Reflections. Nice to be talking to you.
Well, David, I really do appreciate the invitation, and it is great to be talking to you as well. I followed your podcast work for a number of years, so you're definitely an inspiration to me, and so I was thrilled to get the invitation and definitely look forward to speaking with you.
Well, I hope and I trust that this will not be the first and only conversation we have directly. Yeah, I've seen you been making a bit of a splash on the kind of the Criterion-related Facebook groups. I know you've been posting on my Facebook page for really a number of months now. And after I sort of started seeing, hey, this guy, he's putting out the content. Yeah, he's serious about this. He's going to be sticking around for a while. I said, at some point, we are going to have to make a connection because, you know, as you know, I've been doing this for a while, and it's been a very fun hobby, a very satisfying little sideline for me. And I always am intrigued and appreciate when I see new voices getting into the mix there. And I do want to give you a chance to introduce yourself to our listeners and talk about 20th and 21st movies. You know, maybe some of my regular folks haven't kind of gotten into your stuff yet, but I definitely want to get them the encouragement to check out what you do. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your YouTube project and what you got going on.
Sure. Well, yes, my name is James Merritt. I just love film. I love, you know, movies. I love the art form that is cinema, just in so many different, you know, formats that it comes in, the different genres, and just throughout all the periods of cinema, there's so much to experience and to learn, you know, from cinema. And for me, it's just a casual, I guess, similar to what you described. It's really just a casual hobby, just something that I enjoy. Discovering new films, new filmmakers, that are out there, films I've never heard of, filmmakers I never heard of. And that's part of the reason why I got into developing content around this particular area, was to get out there in the community, you know, hear from other people about films that they're enjoying and that they've experienced, filmmakers that they love. And I discovered a lot through that process. And of course, you know, with the Criterion Collection, you know, given that catalog of what, over 1,200, you know, films from around the world, it's just a great opportunity to get exposed to, you know, filmmakers from everywhere that otherwise, you know, I would never have gotten exposed to. So I do content on YouTube at a YouTube site called 20th and 21st Movies. And I put out a lot of Criterion related content. In recent years, I've gotten into Arrow Video as well as Kino Lorber. And I talk about other, you know, things in film outside of Criterion, such as I've really been loving these Dune movies that Denis Villeneuve has put out the last couple of years. Dune 2 is, I have got to get back to the theater and see it again. I absolutely was blown away by that film. And so I just love, you know, film and cinema and just the discovery that comes, you know, from it. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter, Instagram at 20th and 21st, and Twitter, or X now, at 21st. So love talking about films, love hearing other people's experiences of films and learning from it.
Well, fantastic. Well, again, really happy to have you on board. And I figure we will be talking movies for a while. I look forward to making you a returning guest as however your schedule allows, because I like your perspective. I love the kind of eclectic nature. You're pretty quick on the new release reviews as well. You give the listeners and viewers a chance to kind of see what's in store if they want to take the plunge and pick up the latest Criterion releases. So just appreciate what you do. And again, happy to be talking to you one-on-one.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
All right. Well, we are here to get into Wattstacks, which, you know, there is a disc release out there. It's just an old DVD from Warner Archive back from 2012, 13, 14, somewhere in there. And there was another edition produced in the early 2000s. This is one I would love to see come to the Criterion Collection in a fully stocked up Blu-ray, or dare I even say 4K edition. But, yes. You know, I really appreciate, you know, your willingness to come on and tell us about your responses to this film. It was streaming on the Criterion Channel for a while. It's no longer available on the service, but in my podcast, we kind of talk about, you know, whatever the Criterion Channel or Criterion Collection, as far as disc releases are concerned, whatever they feel fitting to put their little imprint on, I'll talk about it if it's in my little sequential timeline. And here we are in February of 1973, taking a look back at that time of what was happening in the city of Los Angeles in 1972. So, James, tell me, have you seen Wattstacks before? Have you had any experience with this film?
This was my first experience watching this movie. I've heard of it. You know, I've heard of it before, but never sat down and watched this one all the way through. And what an experience. I mean, this is a really powerful documentary. I mean, I really love that you picked this one, because the 70s is, I probably would say, is my favorite decade of cinema.
Yes.
For sure. I just absolutely love the vibe of the 70s and just the there was a lot going on during that time coming out of the 1960s, which was a very, you know, pretty tumultuous period, including civil rights and just a lot of the social unrest that was going on during that time. And this film in particular is sort of a response of some of the riots that were going on in Los Angeles, I think 7 years prior to that. But just, it's also just a response to, you know, what was going on, you know, coming out of the 60s. And it definitely has a lot of social commentary, some good musical performances, and it just puts it together in a pretty nice package. I would imagine there's a lot of extra footage on the cutting room floor that to your point, I would love for Criterion to get a hold of this in a physical format and release this with some nice special features, never before, or just some just extra footage, just the whole nine. And that's something I love. That's one of the subgenres of Criterion that I love that they cover, which is like music documentaries. And of all different kinds. One of my favorite releases in recent years is The Last Waltz, the Scorsese film. And I mean, not only does the music sound great, but it's on 4K. It looks it looks amazing. And it's, Scorsese shot so cinematically and just beautiful. Like, or like Gimme Shelter or Festival or Monterey Pop. So this is the type of film that I think would fit beautifully in that, if if they're willing to put it out on a physical format, and there's a lot of material that they could include in it. But yeah, I love the period that this film takes place in, and so much of the commentary that's in it.
Yeah, that was definitely something I talked about in the previous segment with my friend Richard. I don't know if that extant footage is out there. I mean, I imagine they shot a lot more than what made it into the final cut. But then the question is, were those extras, were those remnants preserved in a form that would be, suitable for supplemental features? Because, as I said, some of the acts are kind of cut off right in mid-song, and it's like, oh man, I wish they could have just kept that going. And I understand, for the sake of a feature, sort of documentary slash concert film, you got to keep things moving along. But there's a lot of great music. I don't know if you've gotten into the soundtracks of Wattstax, but there were a couple of LP editions, double album sets that were released back in the 70s. And now there's on streaming media, there's a very long set called Sold Out, the Complete Wattstax, which not only has pretty much the entire concert, but also a lot of the supplemental performances. As you know, there were segments of the film that were filmed in like local churches and nightclubs and other places. So there's just a kind of an explosion of music and culture coming through here beyond just that one event that happened at the LA Coliseum in August of 1972. So, yeah, I'd like to hear a little bit more of your response to the film. It sounds like you had a pretty positive take on it. First exposure, but obviously some of these acts, Isaac Hayes in particular, the Staple Singers, others, they've kind of established their legend and their credibility and their sustained power. I know you did a review of Shaft not that long ago when Criterion did the double, the 4K release and Shaft's big score. So, I mean, I want to kind of give you free rein. Tell me your impressions of the film, the music, or whatever else kind of first comes to mind.
Well, definitely. Yes. Shaft. I absolutely love that film. And so, it is, again, one of those 70s films. And so seeing Isaac Hayes come out with the big, build up to him coming out was pretty awesome. I really dug that, and just hearing his, hearing him sing Shaft and hearing him sing Soulsville, which are, featured prominently in, in the feature film. Just wonderful. I mean, I just absolutely love that. I do want to revisit this film to get more into more of the performances. Another notable performance that really touched me, that was a little bit of a surprise, as I wasn't sure what to expect, was, and when I heard the opening bars of the song, it was I Don't Want to Be Right.
And oh yeah, Luther Ingram, right? Yeah.
Yes, Luther Ingram. When I heard those opening bars, the first thought that came to my mind, because this took me back to, some music that I would listen to, from the past that my parents had. It took me back to like those old Millie Jackson albums, and I was thinking, oh, Millie Jackson's going to come on the stage. And I didn't know it was Luther Ingram singing it. I love his rendition. Maybe he sung it before Millie Jackson did, but I love that song. Like, if loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right.
That sums it right up.
I don't wanna be right. If being right means being without you, I'd rather live a wrongdoing life. Your mom and daddy say it's a shame, it's a downright disgrace. As long as I got you by my side, I don't care.
I love that, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, the music is powerful, but it's I think what really works for me for a film like this, similar to other films, is you have those musical segments, which sometimes, I mean, some are, you know, some can be hit or miss, and some, like you said, you may want more of it, but you have those musical pieces, but then you also break away and you have, you know, some commentary from different people. I was very intrigued, you know, listening to Richard Pryor, you know, during the different segments and, you know, hearing him talk. Which he is quite a hoot.
I mean, just screamingly funny, and at the same time, he's laying down some pretty heavy thoughts and observations of just kind of where it's at, you know, in terms of society and culture at the time, as well as, you know, kind of speaking truth that endures to this day in some ways. You know, it's quite a remarkable slice of social commentary. And yeah, again, I kind of said in the earlier segment, this is a time where, you know, the emergence of kind of a positive Black consciousness is really kind of coming, you know, maybe into a mainstream of a sort, you know, that, you know, there was a lot of turbulence, like you said, in the late 60s with the, you know, the Black Panthers and kind of a more of a militant approach. And even the debate within the community between the approach of Martin Luther King, you know, the kind of, you know, radical nonviolence and a little bit more of an activist provocative approach from Malcolm X and the people who followed in that tradition. You know, you got Jesse Jackson up there as a young man, powerful voice, I Am Somebody, and really building a very positive sense of identity. Wherever you're at in the social hierarchy, whatever your economic status is, you don't have to bow, you don't have to shuffle and scrape, you know, you are somebody. And I really appreciated that, but this was in some ways a very challenging message, and one that was perhaps in some sense even kind of controversial at the time. Just kind of wanted to hear some of your thoughts about just kind of sort of the cultural, you know, statements that were being made there and you know, kind of how it spoke to you in your own experience.
Well, I do love like Jesse Jackson's sort of bookending things, like opening it up with that I Am Somebody and then it ending with the I Am Somebody. I just thought that was just perfect. But I definitely enjoyed hearing the perspectives of, you know, Richard Pryor, the different people who were talking. There was one actor in particular, and I couldn't remember his name to save my life. But
is that Ted Lang, maybe?
Was he from Love Boat?
That was him. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay, this is a pre-famous Ted Lang. He was just a dude off the street.
That face is so familiar. who is he? I'm trying to place him. Yes, Ted Lang.
Yep, that's
yes.
Him.
So
yep.
That was him pre-Love Boat. It was so fascinating hearing the different perspectives, because to some extent, you know, because everyone's experience is different. You know, I'm sort of that that first generation post Martin Luther King. You know, you know, I came along after, after, you know, his assassination, and so I hear a lot of experiences from my parents and my extended family about things that they had went through, and then I compare that to my own experience. And some of the things that I've encountered is very different than the things that they've encountered. So there's a lot that I heard in terms of the perspectives that I could relate to more vicariously based upon their experiences and what they have shared about what they've seen. And then there's some things that, you know, I have had more of a direct, you know, experience with and could relate to more directly. So that's definitely a takeaway from me is with a lot of the social commentary, it's talking about the experiences in general that a lot of people are experiencing, but each individual's experience is going to be different in terms of the extent and degree that they're going to encounter some of those things. So, but it's definitely fascinating hearing the different perspectives of how, for example, Black men and Black women relate to one another. Of course, there's broad diversity in that, but you get a perspective from the people you know, from their point of view, you know, in terms of, you know, black people's experience in society at that time. Definitely fascinating to hear, you know, hear those perspectives. And so I really did appreciate the breakaway and hearing that, because it really puts this concert into the context historically that is taking place in, and the issues that were going on at that time, but then also issues that, you know, still are around today, you know? And so that's one of the things I really appreciate about a film like this, and is just the, I love film that entertains me, but I also love film that educates me and exposes me to history and to learning more about, you know, the world that I'm in today, mm-hmm. based upon where we came from, you know? Yeah. So, I just love that.
Yeah. And you get the sense that some of these folks are kind of just laying it down very real, very from the heart, and maybe captured in a way that they had not been allowed to speak before, or at least not been heard by broader society. I mean, a lot of the quotes, a lot of the perspectives probably had not been captured on film with the same sort of, you know, from the gut authenticity, you know, because there had been kind of a code or a sense of you can't really tell it like it is, you know, because that's just too much for, you know, for people to handle. And that's what I really felt like. This was a chance to say, speak your truth, you know, the camera's yep. rolling, the microphone is on, just say what you got to say, and we'll yep. capture it for you, and we'll put it in this film. Yeah. I don't know how
be proud of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, feel empowered as a human being, as a man, as a black man, as a black woman, be empowered in society and in the world. And, you know, even though people are facing, you know, adversity, like coming out of the, you know, riots from yep. years ago, or the oppression from the civil rights movement, the inequality that people are experiencing, police brutality, all the different issues, is all of these areas of adversity that pile up, but you can still face those and be resilient in the face of adversity. And I think that's a big part of the message, you know, of the film as well.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I don't know how much you had a chance to read up on it, but the director is a guy named Mel Stewart. He was a white man, a Jewish man, who had really been brought in because he had had some experience making documentaries, and mm-hmm. He was basically a director for hire, although I think he probably had a bit of a, you know, progressive perspective and wanted to sort of, you know, capture more than just a concert film. I think after he had gotten all the concert footage, in fact, he put it together as a rough cut of like, okay, here's all the different acts and but we needed a little something more, you know? And so mm-hmm. there's kind of a backstory of how he decided to conduct some of these interviews, how he was referred to a nightclub in Watts about this young, promising comedian, Richard Pryor. He went down to see him. He was the only white guy in this particular club. and it's like, you know, but he, you know, he had a black friend who brought him in and said, hey, he's cool. You know, that's why he can belong here. And he basically saw Richard Pryor stand up and said, I got to get this guy. He's like the last missing piece. And so mm-hmm. Mel Stewart, the director, was the guy who was kind of right off camera, just kind of throwing little prompts at Richard Pryor. And Pryor was just basically riffing, just spontaneous takes. And so just showing a little bit of his genius before he became a pretty successful and celebrated movie star himself. You know, he was just a hungry stand-up guy who was looking for the next big break. And I think this was one of the avenues that he followed to become a lot more of a prominent figure in popular culture. But so, yeah, so, and I really appreciate the fact that they just didn't do a straight up concert film, because yes. as much as I would have loved even more of the music, and we can talk a little bit about some of the acts and all, I agree that the whole cultural context, the lives of the people who are filling up the LA Coliseum on that afternoon and getting down and celebrating their culture, their music, their history, their present realities, yes. that really enriches the whole thing. It's not just an entertainment show. There's a lot more going on than that. But I want to ask, what were some of the favorite, as far as the music part, that you know, the Watt Stacks event itself, any particular acts that caught your fancy or that you want to kind of comment about? I'm kind of curious to hear what you thought.
I mean, mainly it would be certainly Isaac Hayes,
sure,
you know, at the end there, and Luther Ingram were for me the standouts, because I just sort of struck a chord for me, mm-hmm, hearing that if loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right. Yeah. You know, seeing the Barquets doing their thing for there was pretty cool. You know, that funk, you know, and soul band.
Yeah.
They're definitely, you know, they have, you know, some pretty high energy.
And, oh, absolutely.
And
to hold the attention of 100,000 seat Coliseum. I mean, that is no small feat. You know, I've spoken in front of some crowds and never anything quite like that. You know, Richard and I talked about Rufus Thomas. I mean, he was a showman, you know, the guy in the hot pink fuchsia get up there, his white knee go-go boots and all that. I mean, but he had that crowd in the palm of his hand, and it was quite remarkable, just seeing the energy and you know, just, you know, all the celebration and joy that music stirred up, you know, that it just had to be quite an incredible vibe in the place there. And you can see when it spills over, when the crowd jumps onto the field and they just can't contain themselves anymore.
Yeah. I mean, the Staples Singers, you know, Respect Yourself, you know, yep, which, you know, you listen to some of that and you're like, oh, okay. And you sort of make connections to, okay, I see where Madonna got some of the, you know, pieces of like Vogue, like that, yep, song Vogue from Madonna, yep, you know, mm-hmm, Respect, you know, I'm like, that's where that came from, you know?
Yeah,
you know,
right. Or, I mean, she recognized the power of the music and said, I'm going to put a little piece of that in my thing and kind of ride their coattails.
You know, I'll Take You There. I mean, just, mm-hmm, just some really good musical performances, which I love music. So, you know, pieces of work like this are definitely special to me. And this is one I definitely want to revisit for sure. And I do appreciate your mentioning that, that sold out, that the complete Watt Stacks. I'll need to look that up.
Yeah. It's like 6 or 8 hours of music. And so it gets into some of the deeper cuts, some of the acts that didn't get captured on film, and some of the acts that were on film, but you get their whole set. And this, it, mm-hmm, seems like the concert really was put on as kind of a review. I think Isaac Hayes had pretty much a full hour. You know, he was the headliner. Some of the acts only got like 3 or 4 songs, but they kept things moving. You know, this was a very, you know, briskly paced program. If you do listen to the full soundtrack, you're going to hear some extended scenes of kind of crowd management. Rufus Thomas in particular, as he's trying, you know, he got everybody up there doing the funky chicken. It's like, okay, well, you know what? We got to get you back off the field and back up into the stands there. But again, the enthusiasm is pretty contagious. And I just really loved it. You know, as a kid, I remember watching Soul Train and just kind of getting into, you know, the power of the music and just that infectious enthusiasm. And this was kind of like a whole stadium of that type of thing. And it was pretty powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, of course you mentioned the filmmaker, you know, Mel Stewart, and I mean, this is him showing his range. I mean, just shortly after doing Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory,
exactly,
you know, he turns around and he's doing this, you know,
yeah,
totally,
yeah,
different stuff. And, you know, and it's an example that, you know, you don't, you know, he's a, you know, a white man, a Caucasian man. He's not a black, you know, black man, but that doesn't mean he can't do a great, awesome film that communicates a lot about the black experience. I mean, similar, yeah, to, you know, a good filmmaker and a good storyteller can relay the human experience, because, you know, ultimately, you know, the black experience is a subset of the human experience.
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
And if you're,
yeah,
a good storyteller, you can do a good job with that. Similar to what Michael Romer did with Nothing But a Man, you know,
mm-hmm, yes,
which I, yeah, discovered recently, you know, which really, really good film. I mean, a good filmmaker and a good storyteller can definitely, you know, bring forward some good stuff.
Well, yeah, and I think these Jewish directors, probably could relate in some level of some of that outsider experience. They're not really embraced by the, you know, the power structure, if you will, of society. You know, obviously the Jewish experience and the Black experience are different in some profound ways, but there's some crossover. And I do appreciate the fact that, you know, Mel Stewart and the other people behind this production, were willing to give the Black voice prominence. You know, this was a, I think a very excellent collaborative effort, and it does seem like a film that deserves more attention. You know,
I think so.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I, you know, obviously for some viewers, they may be a little bit taken aback by the frequent use of the N-word and just kind of some of the bluntness, if you will, of how the folks were talking. Do you want to talk just a little bit about that and the kind of the cultural context of the times and all that?
Sure. Yeah. I think you hit on it perfectly there, you know, because that was definitely part of my reaction. And I think that is the type of film that I would encourage people to experience and to, you know, sort of experience it and let it wash over you and realize, hey, this is sort of a historical, sort of artifact, if you would. It's talking about things that were going on at a particular point in time. And, you know, I think it's good for people to be exposed to this type of a thing because, you know, we're not too terribly far removed from a time where these issues were even heavier and more immediate than they are today, even though they are still here. But I think something that, I don't know who coined this phrase, but if we forget our history, we're doomed to repeat it. And so it's really important to understand, you know, some of that history and what's going on during this time and some of the issues that were being dealt with. And, you know, heavy racism was going on. And, this is something that people should be aware of. So it is, I think it would be offensive to a lot of people. It sort of was an adjustment for me sort of hearing it so many times, but it's also something that I think is good for people to experience, to just be reminded, hey, you know, these things were going on back then and we don't want to forget our history.
Right. And it wasn't that long ago either. I think that's the thing, you know, like this is living memory for a lot of folks. You know, I was in my early, you know, preteens when this movie was released. I remember hearing some of that kind of dialogue from some of my elders, you know, and I had to go through my own process of, you know, what we call healing racism. And it's a continuing ongoing work because, you know, we're all kind of, a lot of us were raised in an environment where there was a lot of ignorance, a lot of presumption, a lot of, you know, misunderstanding and frankly, a lot of contempt and hatred, you know, and so to just really emphasize that this was not some relic from the past in terms of long forgotten days. You know, a lot of these folks are still with us, you know, and a lot of these ideas continue sort of kind of festering there. So I did appreciate, again, the candor of it all, even though sometimes it got a little bit brutal, a little bit, like, you know, kind of unflinching, like, whoa, they went there, you know, but it's important to encounter that. Yeah, for sure.
Yes. Yep.
All right. Well, you got any other comments, any other final little nuggets you want to kind of point out or you know, bring to attention there?
Really, just mainly, I really appreciate your, you know, bringing this one to sort of the front for me because I had heard of it, but never like encountered it in terms of watching it all the way through. But this is definitely one I need to revisit. Because I think it's a special film. It's a film that I think would fit beautifully in the Criterion Collection.
I believe so.
Great addition, and I would be surprised if they're not at least considering it, because it's a landmark piece of cinema, and it's the type of film that I can really vibe with, because it has so many connecting points to other films of the time that I love, like Shaft. Mm-hmm. It just is at that perfect point in history in the 70s where it just really hits me at a special place. The music, the vibe of the people, it just touches on history and just really, really connects with me in a special way. So I definitely need to revisit the film and look forward to getting it in a great physical release at some point and being able to experience more of it.
Yeah, I think it would be a wonderful addition. And you did mention Nothing But a Man, of a very recent release from the Criterion Collection, and made roughly 10 years prior to this film. And even those little touchstones to say, well, what happened over the course of that decade? Because Nothing But a Man, a much more kind of it's a subdued black and white film, a beautiful story, but mm-hmm. definitely much more low key. And it's about, the struggle that a black man has of just having to endure some of the disrespect, some of the mistreatment, some of the injustice, but having to just kind of grit your teeth and get through it. 10 years later, the black people have more of an opportunity to speak their mind. There's still some risk there, but it is a kind of a benchmark of things that are progressing, of attitudes that are changing. And I think it is. It's a great opportunity to sort of capture history at these key moments and reflect on where we're at and where we still have to go. So very good. All right. Well, James, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking up my invitation. I do look forward to talking to you again. I know we've got some plans to get into another sort of variation on black cinema, the so-called blaxploitation genre. So we're going to be doing a segment on Black Caesar, another film directed by a Jewish man, Larry Cohen, starring Fred Williamson with an incredible James Brown soundtrack. I look forward to digging into that one with you soon. But we'll get this one up mixed and out there, and I'll be looking forward to chatting with you and picking up the conversation from there.
Sounds great. I look forward to it, David, and thanks again for the invite.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks a lot.
Break down.